You're listening to Trek FM.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
I'm going on an adventure!
Welcome everyone to Trek FM's local watering hole, where our hosts from the network and friends just drop by. We talk all things geeky. This week, grab that ale or that pint of bitter, because we're going to be talking about something a little bit special. We're going to do a really fun thing. We're going to have a retrospective here, and then it's going to lead us into the brand new Hobbit film. I'm your host, and joining me on this adventure, this brand new, and not necessarily an unexpected adventure, but because we've been planning it for a while. But Megan and Alice are here with me. How are you guys doing?
Great.
Great. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Welcome to the 602 Club the first time. I hope you guys ordered something from Ruby and are set to go.
Yeah, I got me some mail.
Excellent. We'll definitely try to keep it shorter than the actual movie.
Okay, that's good.
That sounds
that's like a good
idea.
Yeah. You know, Lord of the Rings movies and Hobbit movies, you know, I don't know if anybody wants to listen to talk for 3 hours, even though, I mean, we could. Originally, this movie was intended to be the first thing that Peter Jackson worked on. That was their goal, was to make The Hobbit. And because of a rights issue, it kept them from being able to do that. And in the meantime, he did Lord of the Rings. So finally, around 2007... they get the opportunity to kind of start working on everything. They announced that Guillermo del Toro was going to direct. Peter Jackson would just executive produce. And then del Toro steps away because of all the delays. And they start looking for another director. And finally, Jackson just decides to fill the role again. And we end up with The Hobbit, which was supposed to be two movies. And then about the time that they finished filming the second movie, they decided, well, let's make it three. So for you guys, when you first heard that, I mean, I think this is first things first. This was going to be two movies, and then they made it three movies, you know, and we've seen a lot of this happen in Hollywood, obviously, you know, splitting the last Harry Potter movie. We've split, obviously, the Hunger Games film. We've split the Twilight movie, the last book, you know. It's a big deal to split things, and sometimes it makes sense, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. What did you guys think when you first heard about it?
Well, ultimately, for me, like, I feel like it's just a dollar signs thing. I mean, you can only make more money by putting out another movie, so why not split your franchise into as many products as you possibly can? I already thought it was kind of a strange choice because The Hobbit is such a short book, especially compared to the other Lord of the Rings books. So to split it into two, I was like, all right, that kind of makes sense. But splitting it into three, I was like, that's going to be kind of a stretch, guys. I'm going to be interested to see how you pull it off.
Yeah, for me, first things first would be Guillermo del Toro, because when I heard that he had been selected to direct, to tell you honestly, I was kind of afraid, because although I love his films and he's such an auteur and he has such a distinctive style, and it's a style that for the most part I enjoy, I didn't want to see my beloved childhood book look like Hellboy. You know, like I didn't, you know, like
And you're a Hellboy fan.
And I'm a Hellboy fan, I am, but
yeah, I like the original. It was a really good movie, and it was actually a good movie.
But, you know, the hard thing for, I think, anyone who has a beloved book, and when you're doing film adaptations, you know, as we sort of talked about a little bit already, you kind of have to let things go, but you have your vision of, in your head, of how you created those characters and what it should look like. And if Guillermo del Toro did Guillermo del Toro, it was just going to look so far afield from what I had in my head that I wasn't sure that I was going to be able to get over that.
Yeah, that's a great point, I think, Alice, because, two, it's not as though we haven't, at that point, already had Lord of the Rings movies. So we already know what this world does look like. Now, you know, The Hobbit takes place 60 years beforehand, so there is a change. The world not being completely, you know, covered over by the darkness of Sauron changes that world and makes it darker and, as everybody likes to say, grittier. I was reading today about his ideas, the idea that it was going to look much more like a, he envisioned it really being fairy tale like, and I don't know if that so much works, because it, even Tolkien himself goes back and retcons The Hobbit after he's done, the whole ring exchange with Bilbo and Gollum is actually different in the versions we have now than when it was originally released. He went back and changed that and made it much more sinister and kind of created the way the ring became in The Lord of the Rings. So Tolkien is one of the first retconners of his own work. He's like the original George Lucas. He actually thought about going back and rewriting the entire Hobbit and just stopped. Because it was changing the tone too much, because he realized it doesn't necessarily completely fit with what he created then with Lord of the Rings. So I think we would have kind of ended up with something like that. It seems like if Del Toro had had his way, I feel like it might have been too much out of the framework of what Jackson had already completed. I don't know. It just seems like that might have been... not the best choice. I don't know. It would have been interesting at least to see. Philippa Boyens said, you know, she's still kind of sad that didn't happen. And, you know, she worked on all three and has worked with Jackson for a long time. So who knows?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree with you, because I love Guillermo del Toro, but his stuff is really gritty. I think gritty is a great word to describe his work. Although, you know, Pacific Rim isn't as gritty as some of his earlier stuff. But I don't know. His style is very different than Peter Jackson's. And I think you're right. It would have been a lot different than what we'd already seen in the Tolkien universe on screen.
Pacific Rim is mechanical, right? Yeah. Right. So imagine the Goblin King from Pan's Labyrinth. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He might not have done that. Who knows? I mean, we're conjecturing here, but it would have been shocking for me if the Goblin King would have looked like Pan's Labyrinth. You know, I mean,
that's exactly what I think of, though, too, because, you know, I know he wanted to do a lot of animatronics, and he really liked that. You know, he wanted to take the bigatures that they did with the Lord of the Rings and do even more of that.
Yeah.
And
support, actually. I prefer that a lot of the time.
I think in some ways those really, really work. And I liked the work that they did with The Lord of the Rings. I think it looks fantastic most of the time. It almost always looks better. I mean, I think you can watch Interstellar right now and see the work that a model does.
Oh, yeah.
And it looks real, you know. And so, not to say that... You know, at the same time, I'll say this. The CGI, say, in the new Star Trek movies is fantastic. And it just proves how far we've come with CGI. The places where I'm always wondering, is that CGI or is that real? I can't sometimes tell anymore what's real and what's not, just because it's pretty good. Sometimes it's obvious, and that's just the way it is. I mean, obviously the Goblin King is... CGI, but you know, making a, you know, what, probably 30-foot animatronic thing just isn't feasible
with eyes hand.
Yeah, it's just so expensive. So so now we've talked a little bit just about that. You know, this became three movies, and that meant that they were going to be adding things or moving things around. And tell me how you guys felt about that, especially since, you know, I said Tolkien kind of retcons himself. The scene that we have between Bilbo and Gollum is a key example, and that's really the only thing that really changed to kind of help sell that ring idea and change it so it felt more like The Lord of the Rings. But then he went and added different things in other places. You know, he has Unfinished Tales, which has the whole quest of Erebor scene in it, where you have... Thorin meeting Gandalf for the first time, when we see them in Bree, that we see in the Desolation of Smaug, and then you had in the Silmarillion the whole White Council. The Lord of the Rings appendices deals with the White Council, as well as really bringing to life Thranduil in a way that he's not brought to life in The Hobbit. So there's a lot of places they pull from. What did you guys think about them kind of taking all this together and kind of making a little bit more cohesion between what we've seen before and what we'd get in Hobbit.
Well, it's kind of hard not to, right? Because Tolkien has given us so much that we can pull from. And I think a lot of Tolkien fans maybe haven't read some of that extended universe. So it's a great way to introduce fans to some of that stuff while also catering to like the Stephen Colberts out there that...
Yeah. Stephen Colbert, who could, you know...
He can recite every name.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. It's fantastic. And who's in The Desolation of Smaug as well.
Yes,
so.
He is.
Yeah, I definitely have... I have strong mixed feelings. you know, on the... One hand, me for one, didn't need there to be a greater connection between The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. Even The Lord of the Rings as they did it in the films, which of course is also different from The Lord of the Rings that's in the books. I love The Hobbit as the story it is. And although I can appreciate wanting to... for purposes of expanding my money-making possibilities into three films, pulling from these other places, I don't feel the quote-unquote need to bolster that story in any way. I think it stands just fine as it is. So I have mixed feelings. But I can enjoy the film for what it is, you know.
Well, and I think that, I mean, I really appreciate that, Alice, too, because I think that's a great... opinion to have. You know, it might not be your favorite thing, but there are some fans who might not even be able to appreciate the film at that point, you know, and I like that you can divorce yourself enough to say it's a movie, you know, and it's not the book, and I can always go back and read the book. It's always there. You know, they can never ruin that for you because the book is always on the shelf and I can always pull it off and read it again.
I fear, though, I have to say, I fear for, God, I'm showing my age here, I fear for the younger generation, you know, that may never get to the book. You know what I mean? Like,
they'll get to the book.
I disagree.
You know, I might feel that way, except for, I think we're in an age where books drive movies as much as movies drive books. And so... kids are growing up in an age where they're so used to reading the book and then going to see the movie. You know, they've had all of their childhood now on film. You know, they have Harry Potter and Ender's Game and, you know, the Chronicles of Narnia. And I mean, the list goes on and on. And so they're kind of used to, at this point, being able to go back. So I hear what you're saying, though. Because I would hate kids to just watch this and not actually go back and get into Tolkien and because he's a monumental writer,
right?
You know?
So I have a kid, and my experience of my kid and other kids his age is actually the reverse is what happens. He's never read any of the Harry Potter books, but he's seen almost all of the films. Now, he's my son, so the likelihood of him actually reading the Harry Potter books is quite high, but that's because he's my son. I think many kids today see a lot of films that they may not even realize that there are books that go along with those films. But that's not going to happen to my kid.
I do think also that it has to do with the age of your son in particular, because... I know when the Harry Potter movies were coming out, like I was in the age group that was reading the books when they came out. And so those movies were targeted to me at a very specific age. So I think it's just a matter of this weird new production cycle that we seem to have found ourselves in, where authors are coming up with these books that become blockbuster hits on the book charts. And then studios are like, okay, that's the one that we've got to make into a movie. So I think as that book cycle continues, the movie cycle is going to continue. And there are going to be new series of books where kids are reading the books as they're coming out and then seeing the movies later.
Yeah, but what I'm talking about is a book like The Chronicles of Narnia or J.R.R. Tolkien's works, which have been around since what, the 20s?
Yeah.
30s? When did those books come out? Right. So those are very old. So I totally get what you're saying, yeah, that if the movie is coming out like Mockingjay and those books, because those books are popular right now, and that's why the studios are making those films, there's still going to be that generation that comes up behind if those books become the classics that J.R.R. Tolkien come. There are kids who may still come up in the world who know the movies but never get to know the books.
And that's definitely true. I'm sure that will happen.
I think it's a little bit akin to the way that J.J. Abrams' Star Trek movies work, in that they bring a whole new generation in and they're like, well,
I want
is there more of this?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so they go and find, you know, all of the other series that we've had, all the other movies. And I've heard so many people, you know, get into Star Trek that way in the past few years. I think that's great. And I hope, you know, and I'm with you, Alice. I hope and I pray that these kind of movies lead people to read the actual books. And the best part about something like The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings or even, say, The Chronicles of Narnia is that they are classic books that have been around for over 50 years and they don't seem to be going away. And that's great because, you know, they'll still stay on the shelf. And that's where, you know, hopefully when I have kids, I'll, you know, my goal is to read them, you know, I'll indoctrinate them, you know, it's my job to indoctrinate them, you know,
as a good
and
nerd.
Read those books to them. Yeah. When they're going to sleep and those kind of things, and help them discover those things as well. And then, you know, if they don't like it, that's fine, but at least they'll know about it. For me, I guess I didn't worry so much because I really, I trusted Jackson enough to service the material, you know, having watched, you know, at least a day's worth of extras. You know, if I were to sit down and watch all of the extras on those, on all the movies so far, it's probably almost 24 hours or something like that. So I felt like I understood that they really cared about the material. And it wasn't, as much as I'm sure that it is driven somewhat by money, it wasn't just money. They thought they could make great movies that lived up or were, you know, something that you'd want to watch alongside The Lord of the Rings. And, you know, being enough of a Tolkien fan and having read, like you were saying, Megan, enough of that other material that he wrote, you know, whether it's the Silmarillion or the Appendices or, you know, slogging through the Unfinished Tales and that kind of stuff, and getting those tidbits about those stories that Tolkien would give you little clues to other things that had happened. I was kind of excited just to see that because, you know, The Hobbit is one of those books. It's very short and very concise, and like things happen and then they move to the next thing. And it's a little bit episodic in that nature. But there's other things that are going on. And you can tell, like, you know, why does Gandalf just disappear?
Yeah.
And then he doesn't tell you why he was gone and all these kind of things. And so those were just natural additions to the story that I'm glad that they added. Because that White Council stuff, it, I think, is going to be really fantastic, especially once we get to the Battle of the Five Armies. So that's where I'm kind of excited to see that fully play out. And two, those are the kind of things that might drive people back to the Silmarillion because they want to know more about, you know, Galadriel and Saruman and all of those characters that are on that White Council that are super powerful, and figure out where they come from. So that was exciting to me. You know, the things that I are like, eh, whatever. I don't care about them adding Tauriel, you know, the elven warrior. That's fine. You know, that's movie stuff, and that's where I just was like, whatever. You know, bringing back Orlando Bloom as Legolas, it makes sense, you know, from the book standpoint. He's Thranduil's son, so most likely he was there. He's just not mentioned, you know? So all that kind of stuff is fine. And you talked about before we started, Alice, the idea of agency and kind of moving people around, you know, kind of beefing up some of the characters that are small, but then are strangely important, like the bard, who's like really important really quickly in the book. I don't know. It was okay to me to give him a little bit more to do so that once we get to that point later on in the story, it'll make sense. So, I don't know. What do you guys think?
I think Alice and I have similar mixed feelings about the Tariel character in particular. I mean, I love to see Evangeline Lilly get a gig like this because I thought she was fantastic when I first saw her on Lost. And I think she's an interesting character. I think they might have missed the mark a little bit with her. But I'm interested to see where they're going to take it. I know Alice feels very strongly about adding romance to stuff that didn't necessarily have romance to begin with and doesn't necessarily need it. And they're
very
kind of,
strong feelings. I might need a whiskey.
They're kind Bring of hinting whiskey. At a potential love story here, which I don't know. I'm right now. I'm take it or leave it. I'm interested to see what they're going to do with it. But it's fun to see a female elven warrior jumping around and fighting orcs and bad guys and stuff like that. I don't know. I'm patiently waiting to see what happens before I make any final judgments on the addition of her character.
I think one of the things too is that, I mean, we do live in a day and age where geek girls do tend to get upset when there aren't any female characters whatsoever. And Tolkien's writing just,
it's not a female,
it's a different time
space.
Period.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have a lot of female characters. So I can understand the filmmaker's point of view of like, if we put this out there and there's no female characters, how's this going to be received? And
yeah.
And the same issue with Lord of the Rings too. And I felt like on a whole, they dealt with that decently. I won't say it's perfect because it's not.
Yeah.
But so they definitely have that problem now here because there are no female characters in The Hobbit.
Yeah.
So that's a really tough thing to sell, you know, all sorts of people when there's absolutely nobody for them to maybe see and on a poster or whatever and be somewhat excited about. Even if I think the problem is if it's just because she's going to be romancing a character and then you can have a problem.
Well, and that's the missed mark, right? I mean, geek girls, we want to see more representation of people like us in these things that we love. And I appreciate that the studios are clearly making an effort to reach out to us as a group of audience members. But they seem to not fully understand what it is that we're looking for, because romance is not like the number one thing that we're looking for. But again, like, she spends a lot more time jumping around and being action-y.
Kicking some serious ass.
Yeah, she does kick some butt, although I think her poster pose was a butt pose, which wasn't super great.
They switched it.
Oh, that's right. It was Legolas.
They switched it.
It's
Legolas who's doing the chest butt thing.
He's got the butt pose. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, that's fine. It's
hey, didn't bother me.
I'm not complaining. Yeah.
Some guy.
Yeah, I just, I find it an interesting, you know, when you're not in the position of privilege, it's always a challenge. You know, I appreciate that there are more, you know, the princess, and I'm air quoting, the princess problem has sort of been nipped in the bud, considering every Disney princess now somehow knows karate. But you know, I'm that's like a very one-dimensional fix for me. You know, don't just take a throwaway character and make her kick ass. Give me a character that actually has some meat and is the, you know, give me more of a Mockingjay story where at least the female character has some real importance in the storyline. If there weren't women in there, don't just give me a token woman because you don't know what else to do. I just was like, what? This is just so ridiculous. I don't even know. And I don't particularly like that the elves save them when in the book, they don't need to have elves chasing them down in the Barrel Run, you know, shooting the orcs off of them. You know, they, you know, Bilbo fixes that problem for them and they go on their merry way and it's a done deal. All of that additional elves, because elves are cool and people like elves, I didn't really.
I think I completely get that. You know, for me, all of those scenes that they add things like that to, where they give it some more action, is just the movie maker. Whereas, you know, in a book, you can go and you can have them escape in barrels and that's fine. whereas in a movie, it's like it has to be a visual feast. You know, it can't just be, well, we plopped out some barrels and we rolled down the, you know, that's not, you can't tell a movie like that. And you kind of run into that problem. And plus, Legolas got to do some really cool stunts. Like, I was really excited about that.
I think that was one of the scenes, though, when my husband and I saw it in the theater, I think we were laughing the hardest.
The concept that's, I mean, you don't necessarily need Legolas flipping around and doing ridiculous things for it to be a visual feast. I mean, I think that's lazy from a filmmaker standpoint. You're Peter freaking Jackson. You have a bajillion things in your pocket. Don't make something that's going to become a universal ride. You know, give me something a little bit better, please.
I'm looking forward to going on that ride next time. I visit Universal
Studios. That seems like
the
best log ride ever.
They're totally doing that. That's exactly what's happening.
that is not surprising. You know, I don't. Goodness, after watching the extras and knowing how hard that was, oh gosh.
Oh, I'm sure it was super difficult to film.
Yeah, I can't say that was easy. It took them a really long time to figure that out. But I get what you're saying. It makes sense. Okay, well, jumping to our time machine, and we hop in our TARDIS, because this is the 602 Club, and we can jump series like that. And we go back in time, and first impressions of the movie. I mean, we're back in Middle Earth. We've got 48 frames per second, if you saw it like that. And all of this stuff thrown at you. And in the end, the world does look a little different. It's a little bit lighter. And it's a little bit happier. It's a little bit sunnier. What did you think? I mean, when you walked out of the movie theater, you know, the first time after seeing An Unexpected Journey.
I definitely enjoyed it, and we watched it in the 48 frames a second the first time we saw it. Since this came out around the holidays, we were visiting family, and I think we ended up seeing it three times in the movie theater.
Wow.
Because, you know, like, one friend hadn't seen it, and then our in-laws hadn't seen it, and they wanted to go. So I think we saw it more times than we were intending to, but we still enjoyed it every time we saw it. Yeah, like I said, the barrel escape was pretty silly, and we laughed a lot in the movie theater. The 48 frames a second jumped out at me at first, and then, you know, once I got into it, I just, like, whatever. I lost it because I was into the story and everything. And does anybody know, was this also filmed with the, what is that new surround sound called again?
The Atmos?
Yes, in Atmos. Was this in Atmos as well?
It is, yeah. At least I know that the last one is, because a theater up here in Washington has Atmos set up, and they're showing it with Atmos. So
yeah, we have a couple of them here in Phoenix, and I'm pretty sure it was in Atmos. And I remember seeing it, because I'm pretty sure one of the times we saw it was in Atmos. And again, at the beginning, it really stood out to me, and then I got too into the story and stopped noticing. The one thing we did notice was when we were in a run-down movie theater and the surround sound didn't work properly. But because that really...
That sucks.
...deafened the experience for sure. On the little Dolby thing, she just said, you. So she wasn't around us.
Oh, dear.
That was pretty funny. But yeah, we still enjoyed it. I did like that it was brighter and happier and more cheerful, because to me, that's The Hobbit. The Hobbit is a little bit more bright, and it's more cheerful than The Lord of the Rings was. But then they started drawing in some of that darkness and that grittiness from The Lord of the Rings, which I get why they were doing it. I kind of wish it had been left out. I was glad to see Galadriel come back. I know she's not in the story, but she's one of my favorite characters, and I love any excuse to see Kate Blanchett on screen, because she's luminescent, literally as Galadriel. So
I'm gonna agree with you there.
She's fantastic.
You can have her on screen as much as you want, especially in elf ears, because it just
she's amazing. She didn't get enough screen time, in my opinion. Like, we could have
Whew. Let's cross our fingers, because I think in Battle of the Five Armies, we're actually going to see her let loose.
Awesome. And
so I'm excited. What about you, Alice? What did you think?
I have an expectation problem.
Hey, So welcome to fandom.
Yeah, exactly.
So to put it in perspective for you, The Hobbit was the first book that my father read out loud to me. And it is one of the handful of books, I would say less than 10, that I have read more than once. So that story is very well drawn in my head. And my expectations for wanting to love this film were high. And that's always, you know, if your expectations are high, they're very hard to meet. Whereas if you go into a film thinking that it's going to suck, it's probably going to turn out to be better than you thought it was.
Yeah, I think I had like medium expectations when I went into this. I was like, well, it'll be a movie. But yeah, I see where you're coming from.
My expectations were high. So I like it more now. The more times that I have seen it, because my expectations have had an opportunity to level out. But the whole opening sequence where they it feels like they're almost pulling scenes directly from The Lord of the Rings. There are several shots that for me were a revelation for The Lord of the Rings. I mean, that was the other thing for those films, Peter Jackson and Wingnut. No, what's the production company, the one that did all the weapons and the, what's their name? Help me out here.
Weta.
Weta. You know, so much of the work that they did was perhaps not as groundbreaking as The Matrix, but groundbreaking anyway in terms of what he was presenting. And to see it repeated almost exactly in some instances, I was a little bit like, come on, guys. I know you're better than this. But again, my expectations were high, so I've definitely leveled out in terms of I can enjoy the film for what it is now.
Yeah, definitely one of the things that stood out was the 48 frames per second. And what I thought was cool about it is that it worked with all the visual effects. The 48 frames per second actually makes that feel like it fits better.
Yeah.
Because it's going, the frames are hitting you so fast, and it does take a little bit to get used to. But once I did, and of course being in 3D as well, I thought it all looked really good. And, you know, in some ways, Peter Jackson is a lot like a filmmaker like George Lucas, where he really likes the process of filmmaking. I mean, he's using all the tools, and I think it was interesting to see him try something, and history will show whether it actually works or not. And so that'll be interesting. But it doesn't hurt the movie because, of course, you know, when we see it at home, it just looks like it does like in a normal movie screen, and that's where a lot of people end up seeing it, you know, for the rest of our lives. So, but I agree with you too, Megan. I liked it being back in Middle Earth, and then it was brighter and it's sillier and it's funnier and like it's goofier because that's The Hobbit. And I think that was one of the things that I had to get used to because I've read Lord of the Rings more than I have The Hobbit. I've read The Hobbit a few times in my life, but I've also read Lord of the Rings a lot more. And so I'm more used to that darker world. And I had to remind myself that The Hobbit's just kind of a sillier, lighter book in a lot of it. And so until you get to the very, very end with that big battle. And so, you know, having the dwarves come in and they're singing and they're being goofy and all that stuff, I just had to get used to. And once I did, I was like, I really like getting to see this world again. I just like being back here in Middle Earth. Can I live here? I want to go to there. and now I can if I only had enough money to go to New Zealand.
I know, right? Like, we're all saving our money to go visit the Shire.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
My dream home is a hobbit hole.
Mm-hmm. And I thought it was great, too, because they were still putting the same amount of care and attention into all that they were doing, you know, with the costumes and with the weapons and all of that kind of stuff that Weta is so famous for now. And their digital work, too, obviously with Gollum, they've just taken and used that on a lot more characters now because they didn't use quite as many stunt doubles anymore for orcs as they did here, because I think for them it might have just been easier than having to create so many latex suits over and over and over again that they did on the Lord of the Rings, where, you know, they would have hundreds of extras and latex suits, and it was just, yeah. So,
well, and those are so expensive, and they smell, and they're hard to store.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's just so much that people that you have to consider when you have that many extras in full costume, like they did at Lord of the Rings. I mean, nobody does that. Nobody had done that before, and nobody's really done it since because it was such an undertaking.
Right. And luckily, I mean, for them, it ended up paying off.
Oh, yeah, but, it absolutely did.
You know,
did.
If it hadn't, we, let's just say if it hadn't, we wouldn't be having the Hobbit discussion at all, probably. So, well, just kind of thinking in the movie, and we've all seen the extended edition too now, so it's a little bit longer and they've added some things. What are some of your favorite things about the movie? What are some of the things you like? And then we'll move into kind of some of maybe the things we didn't think work as well with An Unexpected Journey.
What did I like?
Well, I like Bilbo. I hadn't read the book before I went in and saw this movie, so I went into The Hobbit totally blind, aside from my Lord of the Rings background knowledge. And at first, I wasn't so sure about them casting Morgan Freeman as
Martin
Freeman. Oh, my God. At first,
boy, that would have been a different movie.
Been a way different movie. At first, I wasn't so sure about them casting Martin Freeman as Bilbo, but I think he really was kind of a fantastic casting job for that character. You know, he's witty enough, he's kind of sarcastic enough, and he likes to not, he wants to not be in trouble, and he wants to just go back to the Shire. And I really loved him as Bilbo. So I think that was probably my favorite thing about seeing The Hobbit for the first time.
Gosh, that's going to be so hard for me.
You liked something, Alice.
I know
you did.
I mean, again, I did. I can watch the films and I can enjoy them. I do like the dwarves. The books for me, again, in the books, they read a little bit more hot and cold than they do, just like Thorin reads a little bit more. He reads less noble than he comes off in the films. But I do like Richard Armitage as Thorin. I like Martin Freeman as Bilbo. Okay. I like that, you know, they get in the important pieces for the most part, and without being too much of a negative Nancy, I like how they've expanded some of the things. I particularly like the trolls, for example, the rock fighting, you know, which I think is like two paragraphs in the book, didn't need to be quite so drawn out for me. But again, all I could think of was like, oh, well, this is, you know, prep for some ride somewhere.
Oh, no, I thought that was so awesome when I was in the movie theater. I was like, I want a whole movie of these rock guys. This is awesome stuff right here.
Yeah, I'm just a dick.
That was one of those things. Look, I remember first seeing the movie in the theater, and I thought, Peter Jackson just made that crap up.
I know. That's what my husband said.
Yeah.
It is in the book.
And then it was so funny because I went home and I looked in the book and it's like two lines.
Yeah, it's
literally like one sentence. Like, yeah, they were back there throwing rocks.
Yeah, exactly. But the coolest part about it was that the visual that Tolkien gives you is just enough to kind of create what I think Jackson did with that. So he took those little cues, and that's kind of what you have to do as a filmmaker when you're adapting a book, especially like The Hobbit, where we've talked about it. It has a lot of brevity to it. Mm-hmm. And so when you're doing a movie, you are going to take those cues like that and make something really cool, because what a great visual of like these mountain people that just pull out of the mountain and start bashing each other's heads in with huge rocks. And you know, in the book, they're like throwing rocks down and hitting trees and watching them smash and everything, you know. So it's like they just like wanton destruction, and they're not really there for any other reason than Tolkien had it in his imagination, put it on the page because he thought it was cool, and then Peter Jackson thought it was cool too, and so he just made it a bigger action piece, and it was kind of fun, and it did a good job, I thought, of kind of leading them into, you know, the fact that they go into that cave, which will lead them to Goblin Town, which was great. So,
well, and that's one of those things too that I think, in the hands of another filmmaker, maybe not necessarily Guillermo del Toro, but that's like, it's such a short part of that section of the book that someone could have just easily glossed over that and not included it in the film, and it was there and it was so big, and I thought it was so well done. I thought it was one of the most unique things in The Hobbit. I'm so glad that jumped out at Peter Jackson and captured his imagination, and he put it on film for us to see in the way that he did.
Gee, I wonder if it would have been in there if it had only been one movie or even just two movies.
I don't know, maybe not.
And that's really interesting, too, because I was reading just online today about, you know, the idea of the split and all those kind of things. And they had actually filmed most of the stuff for 1 and 2. And then they had to go back and film things so that it could be for 3 and then rework everything with the footage. So they did a lot of that work, and then they had to go back and just add things in that would make sense with the story. And especially when they decided that the movie, there wasn't going to be a joint film, like a joining film between Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit that kind of told that story, that they were just going to take The Hobbit and make it into 3. They had to figure out how to parse all that out. So yeah, that's one of those scenes I thought they may have made this a little bit longer, but it was so cool watching on screen, especially in 3D and everything. It just looked great. And Megan, I'm with you. I think Martin Freeman, if he hadn't been The Hobbit, I don't know if this movie would work half as well as it does, just because he really does carry, he has this presence about him, you know, he's kind of snarky and all of those things that Martin Freeman actually is in real life. He just brings to, I mean, he literally
he's
in the,
a bit of a curmudgeon,
on the extras,
right?
Yeah,
he does
likes
kind
to
of
fly
the same character over and over again.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, he does.
Well, and he likes to fly the bird a lot in the extras. Yeah. So
yes.
And actually, you will see him when he puts on the ring, and I think it is the Desolation of Smaug. He's actually putting it on his middle finger.
Yeah,
and he's
I was noticing
you the
that.
Finger, which it's pretty funny.
Yeah.
So I really like his performance. I think that he just really sells that. And I, on the same token with you as well, I think Richard Armitage does a great job with Thorin, because they do change that role a little bit. He's younger. You know, he looks a little more like a virile man. Obviously, they're going for a little more sex appeal with him than, you know, he probably had in the book, you know.
Which is
like
a strange choice considering he's a dwarf.
Exactly.
Richard Armitage
exactly.
would be sexy regardless.
I guess that's true.
Well, that's true. That's
that
true.
Man is
I
hot.
Agree. I mean, the guy's a good looking guy.
He's
I'm not going to lie. So I really liked that. And then the thing that I really enjoyed and I really responded to the first time I saw it was when they do that White Council. And I really appreciated how they were weaving that story so that it made sense for, you know, Gandalf to leave, and you knew why he was leaving, and it was very important, and that's why he wasn't going to be there. And then, of course, it makes a little bit more sense in the end with the five armies battle, and why all these armies just all of a sudden show up. You know, this gives a much better, you know, visual representation for the audience who maybe hasn't read The Hobbit, like you said, Alice, of kind of what's going on in the background, which Tolkien didn't even realize himself until he retconned himself. So, you know, it's like, I don't feel quite as bad of Peter Jackson doing this because Tolkien did it first. So I don't feel quite as bad as for him going back and adding things in. And so I really liked that scene, and I'm with you. Cate Blanchett, we just need more of her and elf ears. So... And then for you guys, you've both seen the extended edition. There's some extended scenes in there with them at Rivendell, with the dwarves there, and things like that. Was there anything that they added at all that you liked, or you're just like, oh, we don't really need this. We could just watch the original version. It'd be fine.
Well, for me, being the one here who probably... it wasn't so on board with all of the additions. It didn't, watching the extended version, it wasn't like, oh God, there's more. I mean, it was fine. You know, the Rivendell piece for me, again, that's written very differently from, or it's shown in the film very differently than it is in the books. There isn't so much the obvious hatred in the book until you get to Thendril. But, you know, the interesting thing about Jackson is he is very good at his job. And so the additions in the extended didn't really bother me. And in some cases I enjoyed them. So it was, you know, neither here nor there for me.
Like the dwarves taking a bath in the big fountain there, you know, which was just fantastic.
I didn't do my geek homework. I actually haven't seen the extended version yet. So
that's okay.
You guys are giving me something to look forward to.
I, you know, to me, just as a Lord of the Rings person, and then with The Hobbit, the extended versions just became what I think of as the films. Like, I don't even think about the theatrical release anymore, just because I never watch them anymore. So I just always enjoy watching the extended version, because in a lot of ways, what Jackson will do with the extended version is add those things in there that a fan appreciates. And so I really like that, especially like with, say, Return of the King, where he adds, you know, what happened with Saruman. It's not quite the same in the book. Obviously, it's very different, but it mirrors a little bit what happens in the book. The fact the way he dies is similar, and the fact that he does die and those kind of things, which wasn't even in the original theatrical cut. You just left and Saruman was just there, and you're like, what? We've just spent all this time talking about how bad this guy is, and we just leave him on top of a tower? So, yeah, that kind of stuff I just always appreciated about him. One of the things I just wanted to mention and talk to you guys about, because this whole movie has a lot of dwarves in it. And, you know, so Jackson has a harder time in this movie than I think he does in the original Lord of the Rings films, is that all of these characters are the same race, and we're with them pretty much the whole time through all three movies. That's, you know, those are the main cast of characters, and how do you make that interesting and not boring? What did you think about how he pulls that off, or does he pull that off?
Well, I think because I'm actually finishing The Hobbit now, because Educating Geeks is actually going to be covering the book. One of the things that jumped out at me reading it after seeing the movie is how a lot of the time the dwarves are kind of like this big amalgamous group. You know, every once in a while one or two of them will come out and have their own scene together, but a lot of the time they're referenced just all in a row, like Oin and Gloin and Fili and Kili, and like six or seven of them are just listed. And then, you know, like we get to know like Balin and Fili and Kili a little bit more than some of the others.
Bomber,
yeah. So I think Peter Jackson did a pretty good job of, there are the dwarves that we get to know a little bit more, and then there's the others that are just kind of like the background dwarves that are along for the ride, kind of like Bilbo is supposed to be. So it didn't really bother me too much, because there are the ones that stand out a little bit and the ones that I'm like, you know, whatever, they're just there.
Yeah, I actually think given the expanded nature of what he's done, he actually has the opportunity to have those moments, like when they're in the house and I can't remember the character's name, who has the really loud burp, for example, or the one, you know, like he has those moments cinematically to be able to give each one a little bit of character through the time that we spend with them that the book just doesn't have the time to do.
Yeah.
So I think in that sense, and giving them a little bit more character, even if it is character that you didn't know they had, I think he does a nice job of that.
Yeah, I agree with you guys. I think that's probably the hardest part of the movie is, like you said, Megan, in the book, they're just this collective, basically, that, you know, a few of them will speak up every once in a while, but on a whole, it's Thorin that you're dealing with, and it's Bilbo that you're dealing with, and you don't really get to know these dwarves. And one of the things that Jackson, the crew, I thought did a great job was is just giving them a visual look.
Yeah.
So you could tell the difference, you know, and it might be a little bit outlandish at times, but again, with a visual medium, it's so important to be able to distinguish your characters and who they are. And the other thing was is just the actors that they got to play these guys, I thought was great as well, because you know, Dwalin, Graham McTavish, you know, he's this big hulking dude, and the way that he plays him, it comes off, you immediately know who he is. You know Bomber with Stephen Hunter, he's just, oh my gosh, Stephen Hunter as Bomber is just hilarious, and he's half the time he's really not even doing anything, it's just kind of the way he walks and the way he barely talks and always has food in his mouth. I mean, that kind of stuff is great. And the way that they give you immediately who Balin is, you know, and with, he's the older one, he's the one who's been with Thorin the longest, he's the one that trusts Thorin more than anything, all of those kind of things, they do a great job visually, and then when they give these characters lines, really setting them apart. And I think that really works, especially with a movie where there are going to be some of these dwarves that we, even by the end of three movies, we still don't really know that well, but we can still appreciate when they're on screen. And that's just, that's a hard thing to do, I think, when, you know, when I think of the Lord of the Rings, even if it was a side character or whatever, they're at least distinguishable. Well, okay, this one's an elf, this one's, you know, a dwarf, this one's a human, and these humans are these humans, and these humans live over here, and there's a little bit different, and all that kind of stuff. It's a little easier to distinguish than when you have, well, 13 of the same exact race, and they're all relatively the same size, and all that kind of stuff. So I really appreciate that. Well, for you guys, just some final thoughts on The Unexpected Journey. And, you know, I think it was kind of an unexpected journey for a lot of us in the sense that when I knew all the legal troubles that they were having with The Hobbit in the first place and why they didn't get to do it first, I didn't know if they'd ever get to do The Hobbit. And so I was just glad when they finally were able to work those out. And I thought it was fortuitous that Jackson ended up being back in the director's seat, because I thought he's really the best person for the job. So I was glad to be back here. Final thoughts for you guys on the movie and where we go from here.
So you might have to do some cutting. I have a question, which is, at the very beginning of the film, you see when Smaug first attacks Dale and goes off, right? You see Thorin and you see Dwalin. Dwalin's a young man. When you look at them together, they look like they're the same age. So then years later, Thorin looks pretty much the same age as he does in those opening shots, and Dwalin's an old man. That confused the crap out of me. I was like, is Thorin under some sort of magical spell that he ages differently than the other dwarves? Like, I was really confused.
It's main character magic.
It drove me batty.
Yeah, that's a good question. Maybe they just didn't do a good enough job of showing you quite how old Balin actually was.
I mean, he does not have white hair.
Yeah, it's a bad visual cue, probably.
Okay, sorry.
So,
anyway, go ahead, Megan.
Okay,
your final thoughts.
For my final thoughts, I agree with you. I'm glad that they were able to. I'm glad that they were able to finally do the Hobbit films. I had been wanting to read the book, and having the movies come out kind of gave me the push to finally do it. But I'm glad that it was Peter Jackson ultimately, because his vision of The Lord of the Rings is one of the things that I fell in love with when I saw The Lord of the Rings movies, was his vision and his ability to bring to life a lot of what was in my head from reading The Lord of the Rings books. So I was glad that we were able to return to his vision of Middle Earth, because it was one that I identified with and I really loved and I really appreciated. I'm looking forward to the last one. I can't wait to see what happens there. I think the battle is going to be pretty epic.
Because, you know, it's only like a chapter in the book.
Yeah.
yeah, for me, I definitely will mirror Megan's and your thoughts that Peter Jackson really was the right man for the job. I think any other, especially if they were a very strong auteur handling that material, it might have been a truly unexpected journey. I will say that I enjoyed Peter Jackson and his writing team's work when they had the creative handcuffs of having to take all of the Lord of the Rings and jamming it down into three books, and what happened to that creative process with those restrictions versus what happened to his creative process when the world was opened up to him and he had to take this very small story and make it big. Just for me personally, I liked what happened previously better than what happened now. That said, I have enjoyed both films, and I imagine I'll enjoy Battle of Five Armies as well.
So if you guys, we don't always do this, but I was thinking about this, since we're going to talk about all three movies,
yeah.
It might be worth doing. So if you were going to give, you know, say an actual rating, not a Trek FM crazy rating, but like an actual rating out of, like, we'll say 10, because that gives you a good range. What would you say for you is an unexpected journey? And you can take that as, you know, we can just do it genre wise or all movies. You know, I would say I kind of judge movies based on their genre, not necessarily always the entire scope of movies. How does this compare to Casablanca and Citizen Kane? Well, it doesn't, but, you know, so what would you rate it? How about you, Megan?
Well, I always rate, I'm like a Netflix rater. So, you know, Netflix has, I liked it, I loved it. And so I just kind of, I go with the words that pop out of my mouth, and I really enjoyed it. I wouldn't say I loved it, but I really enjoyed it. So I'd give it like a solid 6 out of 10, I think.
6 out of 10. God, I'm rating skills just drive me crazy because, of course, they're very...
They're so subjective,
they're
right?
They're so subjective, right? So
that's okay. Hey.
She's saying that she really enjoyed it, and then she gives it a 6, and I'm going like, wow, that's really harsh. You know what I mean? It's, so... I would probably give it more like a 7.5. Again, I can enjoy the films, but for me, they were too far afield from my childhood memories.
Well, and it's funny because, you know, I'm with you, Alice. I'd say that this first movie for me is probably like a 7.5. So I think, you know, it's definitely, when I think of all of the Middle Earth films, as we could call these, you know, this isn't the strongest, but it's also not a terrible, god-awful movie.
No, it's just not
the strongest, yeah. You know? In a lot of ways, it mirrors Fellowship of the Ring. It's mm-hmm. setting things up. It's a road movie. The unfortunate part with The Hobbit is that we'd already been in all of these places before. The only place that was new was Goblin Town, really. And that turned out to be an interesting, fun adventure and...
Amazing physics involved.
Yes, amazing physics. And in fact, before we end, I just have to say, the only part of the movie that I actually don't like is that part there where they are falling down on that bridge. I'm like, oh, Peter Jackson, you've gone too far.
Yeah, you went a little far there.
I'm not afraid to criticize and just be like, Pete. Bro, yeah, just pull it back. Just pull it back about by 20.
Gravity, I know, don't you work usually that like, way.
Yeah, usually he likes to make things bigger and it works, you know, like the mace of the Witch King, make it bigger, you know, that kind of stuff. I get that. Having them fall down and they're all alive and then a Goblin King lands on them, it's just too much.
Yeah.
So, oh, before we go, because I think this is important, we need to talk about, because it's the biggest scene in the movie. And we didn't talk about it. And so we did final thoughts and we did our ratings, but this is the 602 Club and we just got our second round from Ruby, so forgive us. What did you think about the riddles in the dark scene? I mean, this is the only time that we get...
we didn't talk
Gollum.
About that. Look at
I know,
that.
We
yeah,
didn't talk
wow.
about that.
Big
we got to talk about it. Yeah. But so we had Gollum back. You know, we have the technology now. He looks incredible. And that whole scene, what did you think about that? Because it's probably the most pivotal scene in the book, especially the way it plays into the next series.
I liked it, actually. They do a nice job, you know, because there's the very important speech that Gandalf gives Frodo about Bilbo staying his hand and, you know, thank heavens for the... compassion of Bilbo, and I think they do a very nice job of showing that in this film. If I remember correctly, in the books there's more riddles, so in a movie that we have, you know, 9 hours to work with, we chose to use less riddles, but I enjoyed that scene a lot, actually. That and the trolls would probably be my two favorite scenes.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it was a great scene. I thought it was well done. Now that I've read the book, I thought it was really faithful to the book without being quite as long. Great riddles. Like, Tolkien,
my son loves those.
He's so much more clever than I am, because there's no way in hell I would ever even think to come up with those. But no, I really enjoyed it. Gollum is always he's always an interesting character to see on screen. I think he's really well played by Andy Serkis. Like, he owns that character. And to see him bring that back was just great.
He did a bunch of second unit directing on.
Yeah, he did. He's a director.
I don't think people really realize that
about him.
And he does a great job. So
yeah,
you know, he really if you've watched the extras, you know how much Peter is stretched thin with these films, all of them that he's done. He's always having to be at 20 places at once, and he found some guys, you know, for The Lord of the Rings and now with The Hobbit, like Andy Serkis, that he can really trust, who know his mind and the way he thinks, that do just a fantastic job. And, you know, this scene, because it's the most important scene in the book, I thought it was honestly the best scene in the movie. They really pull it off. The scariness of Gollum at that point, too, is really good. You know, obviously, he's just dragged off a goblin to eat that's fallen. And the fear in Bilbo's eyes, knowing that he is playing for his life. Because, well, Gollum lets it slip that, yeah, if you don't mix it, we eats you.
Yeah.
The visuals are fantastic. I never don't believe that Gollum's not just standing there, you know, or, you know, crouched there next to Martin Freeman as Bilbo. It's just amazing. So I think that scene really does work. And it really is one of those things that the message of The Hobbit and the importance of where real courage comes from, I think I agree with you, Megan. It plays so well with how they film it and they frame it. And then, of course, you know, now it's kind of like the Star Wars films. If you watch the first three with the last three, there's a new way of looking at it. So now if I watch, you know, Hobbit 1 through 3 and then go to the Lord of the Rings, you know, things are going to connect in a way that they maybe hadn't for me before. And so that'll be really fun to do one day when they're all out and I can sit there for a few days in a row, because I can't do that all in one day. That's literally like an entire day sitting on the couch for 24 hours. And
my annual Lord of the Rings rewatch will become a 2-weekend Lord of the Rings
rewatch. Yeah, there you go. There you go. Exactly. So, well, guys, it's been so much fun getting to talk about The Hobbit today and The Unexpected Journey, but it's not the only thing that we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here is a quick look at some of the other things that you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And so I was biased against it. Even when I started buying the 2-disc collector's edition DVDs, I avoided buying any of the even-numbered movies.
Odd-numbered movies.
Earl Grey.
Like they stated in the end of the movie, you know, they thought he'd outlive all of them. And I'm like, yeah, that's what should have happened. We should have seen Data, like, in the, you know, 26th century, like, Data 5.0, whatever we call him.
To the journey!
You don't know if she's going to stab him or smooch him.
She's going to smooch him, of course, after dessert.
After dessert.
We all know what dessert means.
Warp 5.
Along with technology and along with trying to study the origins of a lot of different things that we've come to know in the original series and beyond, it's hard to try and deconstruct it without insulting what has come in all of the things that we know of being Vulcan mind meld.
Mission Log, a Roddenberry Star Trek podcast.
And my thought was, in the next scene, Crusher should have the body of the dead Klingon sitting on the back of her toilet holding a candle. You know, which she would only get to do after Lieutenant Yara's gotten to hold the dead Klingon up to her ear to see if she can hear the ocean.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Everything you would imagine would be in an opening title sequence for this show is in there. I think the shot that really does it for me, the shot that really pulls everything together, is when he dunks the basketball.
Melodic Treks.
So we do know an awful lot of people get associated with Vic Fontaine. He name drops to the nth degree about all the famous people that he hung around with, one of whom is Frank Sinatra.
Axanar, the official podcast.
When there's a possibility for something to be misunderstood or not clearly explained, it can potentially open up a big hole for a show, because people can end up going down a path that was actually not what somebody wanted to be done.
The 602 Club.
What are those Bond movies that you go back to time and time again because they just do it better?
First of all, Matthew, nobody does it better.
That's true.
It makes me feel sad for the rest.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we've been talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're an Apple user, be sure to hit that subscribe button. It really helps us out greatly. And it makes it easier for those listeners to find the show when they search us on iTunes. And if you're not an Apple user, of course, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone. And of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Well, girls, I got to say, I'm so glad that y'all decided to drop by the 602 Club and talk The Hobbit with me. And the fact, you're going to be here for the next 3 weeks, so I'm super excited because, this has been so much fun. And I've, you know, with the 602 Club, I thought to myself, oh, I'm so lucky I just started this and we're going to get to talk about The Hobbit movies.
Perfect timing.
But you guys do a lot of other things, so tell everybody where they can find you online.
So we run a media network called Educating Geeks, where our whole...
No, I was going like, that's awesome. Why don't we... You just media nailed network. It. Media Sorry. Network. Okay.
We've been practicing our elevator pitch. Sorry. She frightened me because she thought I was doing a good job. So we run a media network called Educating Geeks, where our whole thing is that we are trying to bring in new people to our favorite fandoms. We're all, even the biggest geek you've ever met in your life, I can guarantee you there's one thing that you love that they have never played or watched or read or done. So, you know, we take that person and we expose them to Star Wars or The Lord of the Rings or Star Trek.
Or Journey,
or the Journey, video game. We do a weekly podcast where we educate somebody every week on a new topic. And then the following week, we put out drinking game rules for that topic because we do like to enjoy the libations. But of course, if you're not the kind of person that likes to drink, you can always play with your favorite glass of tea or
hot cocoa.
Dr. Pepper.
That's right. you can find us online at educatinggeeks.com. And we are also on Stitcher, so you can subscribe to our feeds and get everything as it's posted. And then we're on Facebook and Twitter, Tumblr, and Google+. If you just search for Educating Geeks, you'll find all of our official pages that way.
Well, girls, thank you so much, and I can't wait for next week.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you so much for having us. It's been fun.
Another way that you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and our milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks that we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seat on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support that you can give us, and we hope that you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com. And don't forget to give us an iTunes review. If you give us an iTunes review, I'll definitely give you a shout out on the show. If you'd like to contact us, you can do that at trek.fm/contact. Just choose a show and that email will come directly to us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, you can do that as well. Look in the sidebar on the show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. We're on Twitter at trekfm. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. And we also have our listener-only discussion group on Facebook called The Babel Conference. Just type The Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trekfm and click discussion on the menu bar. And before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor, who helps bring the 602 Club and all of our shows to you each week. And of course, our sponsor is Audible.com. Audible is the best way to get all of those books and read all of those books that you've always wanted to, but you just never thought you'd have time for. And as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial just to see how great Audible is. Go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we really thank Audible for supporting the 602 Club and the network. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make that happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and get your seat on the mission. I want to say a special thank you to our associate producer, Norman C. Lau, and his support of the network and the 602 Club. His Twitter account is at Norman Lau. He's a big supporter of the Star Trek AxonR project and can be found on their official Facebook page as well as the Babel Conference. And last but not least, he's a huge supporter of Trek FM on Patreon. And guys, of course, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also find me doing Literary Treks with Dan, where we talk about the books and comics of Star Trek. And you can find me doing The Orb with Christopher Dones, where we talk about all about Deep Space Nine. Now guys, I just really thank you for joining us, and y'all come back now, you hear?